You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain. Good morning and welcome to Worm's Eye View Grassroots News, the show where young journalists turn the mainstream news headlines on their heads. Today is January 14th, 2011. I'm Preet Burke.
And I'm Mandavni Thami. In today's show, we take a closer look at the current nature of welfare assistance programs across Canada. We will hear from the writer Alexandra McHugh on that. And just so you know, the song that we heard right before, this was Hot Panda by Start Making Sense.
Then later on in the show, the City of Vancouver has recently made two policy proposals removing height restrictions for residential and office towers downtown and rezoning parts of Chinatown and the downtown east side. These proposals have been made quietly with no discussion of the social impacts and ripple effects of gentrification. We will hear excerpts from a recent public forum on this issue. However, first, today's headlines. Earlier in December, the Algonquin of Barriere Lake and Solidarity activists took to Parliament Hill to demand the Canadian government allow the community to return to its traditional governance code. More than 200 people attended the demonstration in Ottawa. Demonstrators opposed the federal and provincial government's refusal to implement a UN-praised sustainable development agreement between Quebec, Canada, and the Algonquin First Nations. Participants in the rally said the Harper government is trying to derail the agreement by imposing Section 74 of the Indian Act, which would impose a banned council system on Barriere Lake. Fewer than a dozen community members cast ballots in the Indian Act electoral process, while nearly 200 people signed a resolution rejecting it, wishing to preserve the traditional governance system they have used for countless generations.
Over a decade ago, Jose Figuero sought refuge in Canada after he was forced to leave El Salvador as a result of the concerns he had for the safety of his life. The cause of this concern was the death threats that Figuero was receiving due to his solidarity with guerrilla forces that opposed the violent regime in El Salvador. Having claimed refugee status in Canada, Figuero had hoped to eventually attain citizenship in Canada as well. But Jose did not attain citizenship. Rather, last May, he was ordered deported by Canadian immigrant officials. Officials say that Figuero's connections to Salvadorian guerrilla forces make him a threat to national security in Canada. Activists, the Salvadorian community members in British Columbia, and British Columbian politicians argue that the immigration officials' decision to deport Figuero is a big mistake. As Laura Avalo, president of the Salvadorian Canadian Association of Ottawa, points out, Canada is not respecting the peace agreement, but by honoring Figuero's case and giving him the exemption, we would be continuing the peace process in El Salvador. Activists have made references to the United Nations Truth Commission report. In this report, it is clear that government officials were responsible for 85% of the violence that occurred in the country at the time. Only 5% of the violence during that period was committed by guerrilla forces like the FMLN. In response to the Canadian immigrant officials' decision to deport Figuero, those in solidarity with Figuero have launched a social media campaign on YouTube in hopes of convincing the Minister of Public Safety, Vic Taze, to grant Figuero deportation exemption. The campaign is called We Are Jose. In addition to the social media campaign, rallies will be held in Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal, and Langley, and in front of the Canadian Embassy in San Salvador on Sunday, January the 16th.
A $10 million class action lawsuit has been filed against Northern Properties Corporation and Denken Restaurant Incorporated, or the companies that have been doing the business at Denny's Restaurant in British Columbia. This lawsuit has been filed by law firms under plaintiff Herminia Vergara Dominguez, who is representing over 50 foreign workers who have migrated to Canada through the temporary worker program. According to the migrant workers, the Denny's restaurants have violated employment contracts. Lawyer Charles Gordon points out more than 50 Filipino foreign workers came to Canada mainly as cooks and servers to take jobs at Denny's restaurants in BC, but were required to pay approximately $6,000 each to an agency that was recruiting employees for the defendants, and they have not received the hours of work, overtime pay, air travel, or any other conditions that they were initially promised. The notice of civil claim that some of the ways that the companies have breached the workers' contracts of employment are by failing to provide the promised 40 hours of work per week and by failing to correctly calculate the provided overtime pay, among others. For more information, contact Charles Gordon at 604-734-8001. You may also visit the following website at www.fgglawyers.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, this song is about a man who lived in the black. But the funk helped him to get into the red. It's called Payday, sucker.
Welcome back to Worm's Eye View Grassroots News. That last song was Payday by Five Alarm Funk.
The dream of a benevolent welfare state may live on in social work theory, conference papers, and mission statements, but as far as frontline bureaucracy goes, welfare is dead. This is the opening line to the recent article, Discipline and Punish, Welfare, Workfare, and the Punishment of the Poor, written by Alexandra McHugh. It appeared in the November and December edition of Briar Patch magazine. Alexandra is a writer and an editor of the Regina-based magazine Utilitarian Donuts. Peter from Worm's Eye View caught up with Alexandra by phone from Regina. He began by asking her to describe what welfare looked like at its strongest in Canadian history.
Well, there's a lot of mythology surrounding welfare that tends to see the period when, a very short period, when it was first instituted sort of in the mid-60s to maybe the early 70s as being its high point. Some people mark its gradual decline starting as early as the oil crisis in the early 70s, and sort of from there, market going away from sort of just providing people with assistance to increasingly attaching work obligations, to becoming more targeted, to sort of seeing fewer classes of recipients as legitimate recipients. And so if it did have a heyday, it was relatively short. And then there's sort of been periods, say, in the when the free trade era started in the 80s with the Mulroney government. You had Mulroney and Thatcher and Reagan. There's a huge sort of overhaul that happened in that period in the late 80s. And then again in the mid-90s, under the Martin Chrétien government, there was a lot of dismantling. That's when the Canada Assistance Plan was actually replaced with the Canada Health and Social Transfer. And what that did was it took away what had been the national standards for welfare, which some people have seen loosely sort of as rights, although they weren't enforceable, which entitled us as a principle to an income when in need, to the right to choose work freely, and a number of other principles, and removed dedicated funding for income assistance, wrapped it up with education and health care, you may remember, in the mid-90s. And so that was another period of fundamental change. But then, you know, those national shifts just opened the door to allow a lot of regional experimentation. It's been seen as sort of empowering different provinces and regions to do as they would see fit. But it also, you know, removed a lot of national funding, and it you know, allowed a lot of variation. Nonetheless, that variation has tended to go in a certain direction toward reducing benefits, toward becoming more restrictive, you know, allowing fewer people to be eligible, becoming more punitive. And I mean, I can talk more about a number of policies that have made it more punitive. And the way these things tend to spread is that different jurisdictions get ideas from each other, and that can go across, you know, regions and provinces, across national boundaries. And so the general orientation, not just in Canada, but in the U.S., in other countries that have been said to have welfare states, you know, operating within a global liberalized trade environment, have all tend to sort of pursue that direction on the whole, although there are some countervailing examples.
So. Yeah, maybe some of those counterexamples would be great. Are there any in Canada where, now that there's no national standard, where you think there is still a good standard?
Well, not overall. In terms of, like, you know, each social services ministry, it's made up of hundreds of eligibility rules and policies, and that operate under their regulations, their legislation. And so there are changes to sort of individual policies that are progressive, and I couldn't say exactly what produces those things, but for instance, in Manitoba, it's gone against the grain to allow people who are applying for income assistance to keep a certain amount of savings and still qualify for income assistance. That's very much against the grain and is sort of an oddity. And because typically people on income assistance in most provinces, the ones I'm aware of anyway, really allow people very minimal savings, sometimes no savings. I mean, BC is one of the worst provinces that I know of. Again, there's some I don't know much about. You know, typically people have to actually be pretty much in a state of destitution, prove that they have nothing in their savings account, prove that they have nothing in terms of assets that they could liquidate to get money. And they're also not allowed to, they're allowed to keep very few of their earnings if they are able to get earnings on top of income assistance. So to see a policy like that, you know, that's one policy that's sort of operating in what is still a generally very regressive overall system that would still help people. And it may be, I don't know that much about Manitoba. I know they don't seem to need as much in terms of advocates, legal advocates, to help people navigate their system. So that to me is a sign that it must be far better than, say, British Columbia, where you have a whole shadow network of advocates with many of them with legal training that are actually required routinely to help people navigate the ministry's policies, procedures, and legislation. And that's just for people to get what they're legally entitled to according to the ministry's own legislation. So the fact that Manitoba doesn't have that elaborate system, tells me, it's just a province I haven't studied very much, tells me that they're probably a lot better off than, say, a BC or Ontario, which I have looked at more.
And could you describe for us, for if you were an individual who's trying to get onto income assistance or welfare, what it's like trying to navigate that system of different requirements? What does that look like on the ground here in BC?
Well, I think, first off, in BC, and, you know, I haven't been there for a few years, but from what I read, it's pretty much the same as when I was there. The ministry starts off with an adversarial position towards what it calls its clients and its potential clients. And so its whole thrust is to discourage people from applying, to make it very difficult to qualify, and to create all sorts of frustrations and penalties along the way, because it doesn't want people on the rolls. It has a very cost recovery orientation, very much sort of a zero tolerance and sort of orientation, and a lot of negatives. Like, it just wants to have as few people as possible on income assistance, which might sound positive or negative, but at any rate, because of that, tactics it uses is just to make it hard. Like, I've read that the BC Helpline, for example, that it's very hard for people to even initially make contact with the ministry. So what it's done is just remove accessibility to people, particularly in rural areas, to make it very hard to actually even make initial contact with a worker to apply. When I was there, it was in an early 2000 period where the BC Liberals had come in, and they did a whole overhaul of their disability legislation and wanted to make it far more restrictive. They wanted a lot fewer people qualifying for disability, for the Disability 2 legislation, where they would be sort of receive a reprieve from work obligations. So they made that criteria just far more complicated, all sorts of hoops that people have to jump through, going to doctors. The doctors have to word their support in a very specific way, or it won't be seen as supporting the person receiving benefits. And then just, you know, setting up employability contracts for people, essentially just creating just a barrage of rules and hoops, and denying people benefits outright, right? Seeming to have a policy to deny people the first time, requiring people to go through appeals, and to have the help of people with legal training in order to have them interpret the forms that they're filling out, know how they're supposed to submit them, know how to go through an appeal process, you know, just all sorts of things like that. It can be extremely frustrating. And you can imagine, especially for people who typically, if they're unemployed, have a lot of stressors already. Everything, you know, a large range of stressors, which can be at one end, you know, extreme illness, difficulty getting around, destitution, homelessness, just all sorts of things that they're already dealing with in their life, and then encountering a ministry that is trying to make things as difficult as possible because it wants as few people as possible to qualify for benefits.
Well, I'm a university student who's constantly trying to navigate my own university's bureaucracy, and they want me to be here. I can't fathom going through that in a system that doesn't want you to be there with all the many more hoops.
Exactly. Yeah. Not that bureaucracies are friendly, but this bureaucracy is extraordinarily unfriendly. Yeah.
And you mentioned how, just briefly there, about how employment fits into that, and you go into that in depth in your article. Can you describe the connection between the welfare system and the labor market?
Sure. The problem is that there right now, income assistance policy and the actual reality of the job market are pitted against each other. Because the job market as most of us know and have experienced, is made up increasingly of part-time, short-term jobs, low-paying jobs. You know, this is something everybody sort of knows, because that a large number of jobs are that, and because there aren't enough of even those jobs, you know, which leaves a certain number of people out from having a job. So because a certain number of the jobs are those jobs that can't provide people with a living, people are put in a position where really they're, it's a forced choice. Their choice is between sort of living in extreme poverty for Canada. It's not absolute poverty as you would experience in another country, but extreme poverty in Canada. You know, either that is employed or unemployed, because those are the jobs that are available. And the income assistance, why I say they're pitted against each other, is because in order for people to climb out of poverty, say if they received income assistance, they would have to have those two working together. They would need their, say, $500 or $600 from income assistance, and then be allowed to keep whatever money they earned from a job. And then if they were allowed to do that, perhaps with those two things together, they would be able to move themselves out of poverty. As it stands now, and this is in every province, you know, and though the amounts vary, people are only allowed to keep, say if they're on income assistance, living in you know, well, far, far below a poverty line, any poverty line, they can only keep, you know, sometimes it's $50, $100 before the ministry starts taking their earnings back. Because, again, that's a cost recovery of the ministry. So the idea is, as soon as people are earning money, well, they should start, you know, living on their own. The problem with that is it doesn't allow anyone to get out of poverty. Now, obviously, those people, the ministry, not caring or not being primarily concerned with the unworkability of that situation, continues to try to force people to choose work over income assistance. But the jobs that are available to most people, particularly people who have been unemployed off and on, or have been taking care of children, people who are at the bottom of the labor market, those are the jobs that they can get. And so the ministry, effectively, what happens is that people just stay in destitution, and that's actually their choice. Their choice is between employed destitution and unemployed destitution, which isn't a good place to stay. You can't stay there for long, and actually, I don't think, really be an employee, function as an employee, you know?
There is obviously fights to increase welfare rates, but what do you think needs to be changed with the welfare system?
I actually am of the view, and once you wade into this area, you actually find a lot of people who are also of the view that it is just so dysfunctional and so irrational that any solution needs to come outside of welfare, something different. Basic income guarantee is what I would focus on, which would be something like we have the guaranteed income supplement that we have for seniors, or like a tax, child tax benefit that just gives a certain amount of money to people, to every person in Canada. Some people use the word citizen in Canada, but let's say to every person living in Canada, and a certain amount for children, and really just allows people to do then on top of that money whatever they would choose to do, to choose, you know, to advance their position further, to, you know, start a business, to take a part-time job. It would just be an enabling income. So in some ways that resembles the welfare system. But why I don't think this decades-old fight to just raise the income assistance rates, which has been, you know, that's a usual focus of anti-poverty groups, you know, and I have often agreed with that. I've been part of anti-poverty groups, and I've just come to see that really a lot of what's wrong with it is a lot of the worst of it actually isn't about income. That, yes, that's part of it. That's the most obvious thing, is that, and the most measurable thing is that, yes, people are living in deep poverty, but what about the way people are being, you know, treated? What about having a whole system that's set up to antagonize people? What about marking out whole classes of people and saying that we're going to treat them differently? We're going to assume the worst about them, and, you know, and then we're going to treat them as though they're untrustworthy. And basically, the only our policy is going to be one that's punitive toward them, to the, where the way we're going to try to encourage them to do what we want them to do, which is to accept any job available, is that we're just going to make the alternatives very, very hard for them. And so I've just come to see that it's more the quality of the relationship with social assistance, the whole assumption that you have these classes of people that should be treated this way by the bureaucracy that should be serving them, and that that all of that is, and that, that eligibility, frankly, is a farce. And so if you were just to raise the rates, but people still had to go through everything that they have to go through to then get a higher level of income, I'm not really sure how much that would really improve people's lives.
But what you're describing also comes really close to kind of our everyday cultural, neoliberal discourse about, you know, no such thing as a free ride, and here, if everyone has a guaranteed income. I'm wondering what you think about that.
We have this idea that if people are punished, if they're put into a hard situation, that enables them to be their best self, that enables them to go to job interviews, that enables them to work, to be productive, to use their talents and creativity. I would rather argue that what we can see all around us is that when you put people down, at some point they'll give up, particularly if it's a totally unworkable situation. They'll develop illnesses, they'll, you know, pursue other ways of making income that aren't as socially productive. Whereas if you are enabling, supporting people, it just involves a different view of humanity. I'd say that there's evidence all around us, again, that people, if given a little bit of support, will try to pursue their dreams, will try to use their talents, will try to, that's the vast majority of people, will do that.
That was Peter from Worm's Eye View speaking with writer Alexandra McHugh. She is the author of the article Discipline and Punish: Welfare, Workfare, and the Punishment of the Poor. If you would like to read that article, you can visit www.briarpatchmagazine.com and look in the November-December edition.
You're listening to Worm's Eye View Grassroots News on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain. For the past year, the Vancouver City Council has been directing an initiative to implement new policy and bylaw amendments to change height restrictions and zoning restrictions for massive, high-density towers and apartment buildings. This directive has been under the radar, but recently has come to light thanks to organizations such as City Council Watch and the Carnegie Community Action Plan. Brendan from the Worm's Eye View Collective attended a recent public discussion of the issue. Here's that story now.
On January 11th, a public forum took place at the Vancouver Public Library to debate the imminent adoption of two new policies by the City of Vancouver. The first, the Vancouver Views and Higher Buildings Downtown Policy, proposes the lifting of height limits for commercial and residential towers, opening the door for the construction of extremely tall skyscrapers in the downtown core. The second, the Historic Area Height Review, proposes rezoning Chinatown and parts of the downtown east side in order to restructure height and development restrictions in the area. There has been no previous public consultation, yet Council will meet on January 20th to vote on the passage of the proposal. The forum on the 11th was well attended, with diverse perspectives on hand prepared to voice their concerns about Vancouver's livability, sustainability, affordability, gentrification, and ecological footprints. City Council Watch, the group organizing the forum, opened the floor with landscape architect Stephen Bohus delivering a lengthy presentation on the inconsistencies in the city's proposal, and the threats to Vancouver's view corridors. Bo has ended the presentation by raising some critical questions.
And the open questions I'm going to have for all the discussion groups is, have the implementations of the view corridors been effective? Are there concerns with the manner that these view corridors have been selected? Are we missing anything? Are there views to protect? Or the big question here is this the best method for protecting views as currently defined? Because maybe there is an overriding policy and it's nothing to do with view corridors at all. And look at other cities. I've asked some searching questions of what does Vancouver mean to me? What do I cherish about the city? How much higher can we go? Is there a transparent and clear process in the community? And how can we fix the process if we're not happy with it?
Following this presentation, with the crowd growing restless, the floor shifted to a set of speakers with concerns other than the view. Jean Swanson from the Carnegie Community Action Plan started things off.
So I'm Jean, and I'm from the Carnegie Community Action Project, and we're in the downtown east side. And gross views are a luxury, complete and utter luxury. And what we're concerned about with tall buildings is the impact of gentrification on human beings and on the lives of vulnerable people who have really no place to go if they're pushed out of their own community by condo towers. So I just want to start out by saying the downtown east side is an enormously creative and unique community that is the soul of Vancouver. And we do have problems, but we have lots of good things too. Our group, Carnegie Action Project, spent 2 years consulting with 1,200 low-income residents in the downtown east side. 70% of residents there about live below the poverty line. And we came up with a list of good things about the downtown east side. Our strong sense of community, the feeling of being accepted and at home, the empathy we feel for people with health and addiction issues. We like having our necessities close and cheap because we can't afford transportation. And we also came up with a consensus on our community vision for change. And we published that in this booklet here. And our vision calls for more social housing, higher welfare and minimum wage, improving safety, legal and regulated drugs, employment for local residents, and involvement of local residents in decisions about their community, and a new image that honors and respects low-income people. So we presented our vision to the mayor, and he said it was a gift to the city. And now we're faced with policies that are going to make implementing our vision impossible. We call this historic area height review, which is what Steve was talking about at the end, the Chinatown part, the condo tower plan, because it would drop at least 7 more condo towers in our hood. To us, this is way more important than views or aesthetics or urban design. We're fighting for the life of our community and even for the lives of the people who live in it, who are going to get pushed out and become homeless. We've seen with Woodward's that condos have what we call the ripple effects. I didn't get a slide made, but here's our poster about the ripple effects of Woodward's. Condos push up land prices in surrounding areas, the towers, especially the condo towers. With higher land prices, hotels increase their rent so low-income people can't afford to rent a cheap room, which is the last stop before homelessness. Low-income people are pushed out of the neighborhood, more become homeless. Only 12% of hotel rooms now are renting for the welfare shelter rate of $375. It goes on. There's more ripple effects. The rents and the taxes for small businesses that serve low-income residents, they're replaced by expensive restaurants, stores selling dog clothes and fancy furniture. Hotels like the American and the Burns Block close and are renovated for richer residents. Police and security guards harass low-income people that business doesn't want near them. More residents start lobbying to stop the social housing and the services that the low-income residents need. And the sense of community and the acceptance that low-income people have because they are the majority in the downtown east side weakens. And the downtown east side, the soul of Vancouver, could be wiped out like Hogan Valley was. We don't need any more density in our community. Just with the existing density, we could have another 9,000 people. That's why we're going to be asking City Council to reject the recommendations of the staff in the condo tower plan, which they call the HAHR. No more density, no more height. We also want Council to A, complete a social impact study in the Downtown East Side strategy with local residents. We wanted them to do this before they adopted any density at all back last January, but they went ahead with going for more density. We want them to ensure that every homeless person and hotel room resident has decent self-contained housing that they can afford, and that the good things about the low-income community as identified in our vision are secured. And we want them to buy at least 10 sites a year for low-income housing in the Downtown East Side for the next 5 years. And we hope you'll support us, and we've got a petition there for the 10 sites, which is circulating. I hope you can all sign it. And if you'd like to go up to City Hall on the 20th and support us, you can give us a call or check out our blog, capvancouver.wordpress.com. Views are important to a lot of people. We all like views, but to us, to a lot of people in the Downtown East Side, this is a life or death kind of situation. And the condo towers are going to push more people out, and we want them stopped.
These things, you know, basically use about 10 times more energy to heat than the lower rise houses that all sun was like. There's no way around it. These things are dinosaurs when it comes to anything, whether you believe in peak oil or just the higher prices of energy. These things are a disaster waiting to happen, and there's nothing you can do about them. You can't retrofit them. And again, don't believe me, believe the city. You can also believe Monty Paulson. He wrote a fantastic series of articles on building typologies, and he said very clearly the world judgment from the passive house movement, from the Architecture 2030 movement, is that mid-rise, low-rise apartment buildings, townhouses, are the preferred building model from an ecological standpoint. Here's the article that you wrote, and I'll read a little quote here. The prototypical Vancouver condo building, towers of poorly insulated glass separated by heat-radiating concrete balconies, provide about a tenth of the insulation of a wood frame home. And whatever your wood frame home is, it's going to be lower. It has to be well up. Finally, I just want to burn this into your memory. The colors came out to you quite different than they were in the original, but we're talking about eco-density here. We're talking about trying to live up to our carbon footprint. Well, this isn't the way to go. And I don't, you know, whatever you think about views, if you care about the earth, that's another reason.
I can usually be heard. I'm very, very concerned because I do really, really watch what's going on politically. And I'm an organizer. And I feel that this, what has been going on at City Hall has been kept under the radar. This has not been coming out in the news, and I consider it a very sneaky move. And what I thought about, I'm from the UK, where they've had a town planning for a long, long time because they've got a lot of people living in a very much smaller area than we have. What I see here is development that seems to be driven by speculators and developers. Not an overall plan. And I was very concerned, the lady speaking about Woodward's, how they presented a plan to the city that was totally ignored.
Yeah.
Now, various citizens groups have worked together in their neighborhoods and presented ideas to the city. They've gone the right route. They've come, spent a lot of time and made good reports and presentations, and that has been ignored. So I'm going to ask the question, why is City Hall ignoring us? Right now, we have Vision Vancouver in power that were elected in 08, and we have the municipal elections coming up in the fall in November 11. And I feel that this is being pushed through because what has happened, and I noticed, do we have any Vision councillors here?
Yes.
We do. Okay, Jeff. I hope, Jeff, that you can speak to this. But I realise that because of the Olympics and the Olympic Village, that the city is short of money. So the one way to get money is to increase your tax base.
And I really do see that the developers and speculators have a free hand. I was looked into what was going on with the Pinnacle development at Maple and Broadway, where we lost a major grocery store. I see that the infrastructure, particularly in, I know, the west side of Vancouver, and we basically are losing grocery stores, and we don't have garages, we don't have the infrastructure for all the condo towers and the people that are coming.
Thanks very much. There's just a few things I'd like to say for context, because there's some passionate views out, and I thank you all for coming out. But I want to start with the question of consultation and the idea that the view issue has just arrived on the scene. In fact, the issue of the view corridors was debated at length last year. I, for one, was surprised at the lack of public involvement at that time, but the issue was, should we relax the view corridors that had existed in the city since the 1980s? And council's decision was very clear. No. We did not even grant planning discretion to negotiate little ragged edges along the bottom. It was a clear cut, no. The views stayed. Okay, you have to start from that point. The view on Queen Elizabeth Hill, from that point, is a view that has always included the skyline. From the day that it was created, through various councils and various political stripes, it's contemplated there would be buildings that would go into the bottom of it, because if you think about it and look on the city website, you're high up, a long way away, and the skyline itself is part of that view. It would be impossible without a building that's the size of, unless it was the size of the Burj Dubai or something, to really get across the mountaintops from that viewpoint. So I just want to be clear on that point, because I do take issue with the view that we're selling off the views. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, the report that's coming, and I see Mr. McCreary, I'm sure he'll have his chance, but the report that's coming forward said, since we are protecting the views, can staff identify any places where taller buildings might work? And as you've seen on the slides, there's a handful of sites where they might. In each case, there'd be a rezoning and a further public consultation. That'll be the case for the Toyota proposal. The second thing is Chinatown. Chinatown is not in good shape. Take a walk through Chinatown. It's a beautiful community, but it has a lot of closed storefronts, a lot of empty space upstairs, a lot of very old buildings. And the Chinese community has been unanimous, I don't see any spokespeople here tonight from there, that there needs to be action by the city to protect the quality of their community and help it evolve in a way they're comfortable with. We went through a very long process there, exhaustive process, lots of controversy if you follow the Chinese media over towers or no towers, where they might be, the size, and so forth. And after a very, very long process, what came forward was a very restrictive approach that, in the view of the people that I talked to after the meeting, appropriately balanced heritage protection with some development in parts of Chinatown. I see head shaking. I'm telling you, that was my experience. That would be on the east side of Main Street and further south. Again, each one of them would be subject to some review, but I can tell you the Chinese community has strong forces who would like to see much more development there than is contemplated by the current plan. So if you come on the China, on the HAHR, I urge you to talk to people who are representatives of the Chinese community and get the full spectrum of views on that one, because there's a great deal to be learned from literally dozens of community organizations in the Vancouver Chinatown Revitalization Committee who have put in countless hours on this story. We'll make one last point on the downtown east side. I have walked the downtown east side with Jean. I've learned a lot from her, not just in the last 2 years, but in the last 30 years. And we have some disagreements about how the downtown east side might go forward, but we have not ignored the downtown east side. We have not ignored the appeal for housing above the library site. We have not ignored the need for fundamental change down there, or the need to support provincial investment in social housing, which is finally starting to happen. And so this is another very, very difficult problem. We don't have a plan for condo towers down there, but we don't have a plan to say there will be no private sector development in the downtown east side either. This is an area where reasonable people can disagree, and I'm sure we will. But I much appreciate the advocacy of CCAP, as others have here. I thank them for doing it. We may not agree on all the possible solutions and where the money comes from, but I think that I certainly don't agree with the suggestion that we've ignored the downtown east side. So I just want to leave it there, Randy. Thank you very much.
My name's Ivan Rury, and I'm a board member of the Downtown Eastside Neighborhood Council, and I'm here because I'm concerned with the condo towers plan that Jean so beautifully and succinctly described, because it means that people are going to be pushed out of their homes. But I agree with what somebody said about this feeling like a moment of the freeway moment in the 1970s, when there was an upswell of people opposing this, that what the city council was trying to ram through as an ideological position. It's been said before that council is addicted to condos because not only do they get kickbacks from their political parties from the developers, but they also have every square foot of condo that's built in the city. So it's not, the change is not going to come from on high, the change is going to come from grassroots developments, and it's necessary for people to gather together and make a stand against it. And I want to argue that that United Front is best built around the Downtown East Side because all of the points that people have brought up here apply to that neighborhood. For affordability, it's important, I think, that we fight for housing for people who live and work and who are the lifeblood of the city, and not for people to have vacation homes, like the model that Bob Rennie's pushing, of how to save the city by selling Vancouver as a resort city. So for affordability, the Downtown East Side is important. For planning democracy, the Downtown East Side is important. Because there is no city in the neighborhood that's better organized and has developed a more cohesive and clear community vision than the Downtown East Side. The Carnegie Community Action Project's vision is based on interviews with 1,500 people that were conducted extensively on the ground in the Downtown East Side to determine what the community wanted to see. It's an excellent example of democracy that the city is blatantly ignoring and going against with the planning for the Towers plan. The same thing with what has been brought up for the environment and for the view corridors. Everything merges there, and I think we need to see all of these people in this room who wouldn't necessarily go to City Hall on a normal day, go there on the 20th, and put this site where there is so much human interest at stake, and put it forward and say we support this and we oppose the historic area height review and the condo towers plan.
While the concerns for the view were overrepresented on the agenda, the forum demonstrated a diversity in perspective and a bubbling agitation with the direction of development in Vancouver. The momentum will carry on as the struggle against Vancouver's tall tower and gentrification plans continue. There will be an action meeting at the Carnegie Hall at 1 p.m. and moving to the Vancouver City Hall at 2 p.m. on January 20th. Come make your voice count.
Thanks to Brendan from the Worm's Eye Collective covering the forum on the tall towers and gentrification on January 11th. An additional public forum hosted by the City of Vancouver will also be held on Monday, January 17th at the Empire Landmark Hotel on 1400 Robson Street. There will also be a gathering for action at the Carnegie Hall at Main and Hastings Street at 1 p.m. on Thursday, January 20th, and also at 2 p.m. at Vancouver City Hall on the same day. For more information, visit ccapvancouver.wordpress.com.
Well, this is our story, but it ain't the truth, cause the truth's just for liars. Need an excuse for a king crown, a banker, a queen crown, a noose like heirs to a graveyard where the dirt's always loose. It's five blocks of universe and aliens for each, like invisible ghettos of privilege and grief and pinned up between them.
And that was an excerpt from Matt Good's The Vancouver National Anthem.
Hey, feminists. Want to learn about a group that is organizing a feminist conference this summer? Want to give them your feedback on your priorities in politics? Then don't miss the Vancouver Consulta for the Rebels gathering that will be this May in Winnipeg. The Vancouver Consulta for the Rebel gathering will be happening on January the 15th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Spartacus Books. That is 684 East Hastings Street in Vancouver, Coast Salish Territory. The Rebel is a national network of young feminists that are self-identified women between the ages of 14 and 35. For more information, visit www.rebel.org or email them at vancouverrebel@gmail.com.
On Saturday, January the 15th, come out to the rally to support WikiLeaks outside the public library. Join the Pirate Party of Canada and the pirate parties around the world to demonstrate your support for WikiLeaks, open government, freedom of the press, and freedom of speech. Take a stand against calls to assassinate journalists and whistleblowers. The rally will be held at 2 p.m. at the Vancouver Public Library Central Branch at 350 West Georgia Street in Vancouver. For more information on why WikiLeaks is good on what political change it has caused, visit sowhyiswikileaksagoodthingagain.com. To contact the organizer of this rally, email greenbucks@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening to Worm's Eye View Grassroots News. We broadcast weekly from CJSF 90.1 FM at SFU on Burnaby Mountain. This week's show has been produced by Maria Perez-Dodder, Brendan Plummer, and Peter Driftmeyer. And I'm Mandavni Thamni.
And I'm Preet Burke. If you have any comments or wish to provide feedback, feel free to email us at wormseyeradio@gmail.com.